As always, it's wonderful to see you all, to sit together. So this week we read the combined parshiot of Matot and Maaseh, the two Torah readings that bring us right to the gateway to Canaan. The Israelites are encamped on the steppes of Moab at the Jordan near Jericho, on the verge of entering the land that has been the destination of their 40-year journey. The parsha begins, "These were the marches of the Israelites who started out, Asher Yatsu, from the land of Egypt." Moses wrote down the starting points, et motza ehem, their departures, by the order of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. The Eitz Chaim translation that we read at TBC uses the word starting points over and over, and Everett Fox, sticking closer to the meaning of the Hebrew words, translates it as their departures. Each word gives a different connotation. But why is this journey marked by starting points or departures rather than destinations of each step of the journey? Perhaps in this great journey, which reflects the journey of each of our lives and the journey we make each day, it is important to get going, to have the intention of moving toward a destination rather than to reach a particular destination. The effort, the intention, walking the path. The word halakha, which means walking the walk, it means the way to behave as a Jew. Halakha is emphasized rather than what is achieved. Indeed, everyone who was 20 years or older at the beginning of the journey, in other words, everyone who is old enough to make a decision for their family to leave, everyone except for Joshua and Caleb, of this generation dies along the way. They never reach their destination, and yet their journey has become the inspirational story that has sustained us through every subsequent journey. The emphasis in this parsha on starting points made me think of a book by Rabbi Naomi Levy, To Begin Again, The Journey Toward Comfort, Strength, and Faith in Difficult Times. In this memoir, which she wrote rather early in her adult life, she describes how she found a way to begin living again, to have strength and resilience after her father was murdered in a holdup when she was 15. Starting out, leaving a place of darkness and narrowness, moving into a more spacious way of being, is indeed the theme of the Israelites' journey. It's only because they were willing to start out to leave Mitzrayim, a place that kept them oppressed and short in spirit, as the Torah describes, that the Torah journey has become a symbol of human resilience, even in the context of tragedy and loss. According to the Baal Shem Tov, who's quoted on the Chabad website, the 42 stages of the journey from Egypt to the Promised Land that are mentioned in this Torah reading are replayed in the life of every individual Jew as their soul journeys from its descent to earth at birth to its return to its source. I won't read all 42 stops, starts and stops, and I won't, but which would make enable us to reflect on whether indeed they are aligned with our own life stages. But let's take a closer look at the first step. The Israelites set out from Ramses on the 15th day of Nisan. We know this part of the story, the morning after the first Passover meal. They were leaving a place of oppression and constriction, leaving their servitude to Pharaoh in order to serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who here we can think of as representing expanded awareness. But when I read this account, you know, there are several accounts of what happens throughout the Torah. When I read this account, what surprised me was an aspect of their leave-taking that had not been mentioned in the first account. In Exodus chapter 12, the start of the journey is noted very simply. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 fighting men on foot, aside from non-combatants. In this review of the journey that we're reading now in Parsha Maaseh, Numbers 33, we read, they set out from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the first month. It was on the morrow of Passover, of the Passover offering, that the Israelites started out defiantly in plain view of all the Egyptians. The Egyptians, meanwhile, were burying those among whom Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had struck down, every firstborn son, whereby Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh executed judgment on their gods. Okay, so this has two new aspects of the story. In the initial account, of the Israelites are described as leaving Egypt in haste with their unleavened dough on their back, which for me gave this image of their leaving in fear, that if they didn't get out quick, they'd be held back. They'd be pursued and held back, which indeed was the case. They were pursued. Yet in this part of the story, the Israelites are described as leaving defiantly, while the Egyptians were concerned with the tragic work of burying their firstborn sons. Now, we knew that the firstborn sons had been struck down, but this perspective emphasizes the reason for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh striking down the firstborn, whereby Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh executed judgment on their gods. So here, the killing of the firstborn is described as a punishment for their worship of Egyptian gods. However, the earlier story in Exodus frames the killing of the firstborn as the final blow that was needed to convince Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. It was about what was necessary for their liberation, as well as to show the Israelites God's capacity for deliverance. So why are we hearing this much more defiant account that attributes the plagues to the worship of Egyptian gods? I didn't read any commentary on this, but knowing what happens next in the story, it seemed to me that this could be part of the preparation, the toughening up to enter a land where they will be instructed to wipe out the inhabitants in order to remove all signs of their religious practice. In the verses that come after the last stage of the journey that's described in these 42 steps, when they're encamped in Moab, we read in Numbers, in the steps of Moab at the Jordan near Jericho, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the Israelite people and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, you shall dispossess all the inhabitants of the land. You shall destroy all their figured objects. You shall destroy all their molten images, and you shall demolish all their cult places, and you shall take possession of the land and settle it, for I have assigned the land to you to possess. Very harsh and disturbing to read, particularly in the context of our daily news from Gaza. So it is as if a literal reading of this verses could, in some people's mind, fuel the conflict. And indeed, we need to be aware of people reading these verses as a justification for military and political strategies. However, for those of us who read the verses metaphorically, our task is to wonder, as the Baal Shem Tov encouraged us, does this particular account of this stage of the journey symbolically resonate with anything in our own lives? Have we ever had to leave an oppressive situation, an oppressive relationship with a partner, with a boss, with any circumstances? Leaving initially with fear of the fear that the Israelites had and that they complained about later. Why did we give up, you know, being able to eat meat and cucumbers? But with a fear of giving up the sense of security that we had in a familiar but miserable situation. Then once we're out of it, in retrospect, do we appreciate, well, that was actually an act of defiance? And then, do we sometimes take out our anger about having been oppressed in the next phase of the journey? Is our inner working model of relationships, this is something that John Bowlby, who studied early parent-child relationships and the reactions of children to separation in the context of secure and insecure attachments. So he said this, is our inner model of relationships now an inner model that relationships are about oppression, the oppressor and the oppressed. They're about dominating or being dominated. And of course, if you had to choose the next time around, it would be better to be the oppressor than the victim. Much of psychological theory and practice supports this view that when we have been raised or conditioned to see relationships as being all about oppressing or being oppressed, it's hard for us to imagine a different way of relating on more equal terms. So, is the liberation we need from Mitzrayim not just escape from Pharaoh, but rather we need to move beyond our constricted view of relationships, beyond this model of relationships that people are stuck in when they've been oppressed, abused, or traumatized? A review of any journey gives us many opportunities to reflect, look back, and see things differently. One might say that this is what we do when we go to therapy. We look back over a familiar story and we see that we have gotten stuck in old interpretations, old patterns that constrict our ability to respond to the present as it is in this moment. Instead of being able to see things clearly, we're kind of programmed to see what's happening in the present as if what's happening could be warning signs of past dangers that we've encountered. And we act to the present with patterns of behavior that we learned in the past. It seems that one of the best ways to become liberated from these entrenched patterns of behavior, these maladaptive patterns, is to reactivate the memories and feelings from the past and to receive new disconfirming evidence in the present that things can turn out differently from the way you feared, from what you feared based on your past experience. One of the amazing things about reflecting on a journey is that in retrospect, it looks like a journey. You can connect the dots in a way that looks like an actual journey, but in the moment, all along the way, you may have felt completely adrift without any direction or having any idea of where you'd end up. And undoubtedly, the Israelites felt that day to day when they complained about the water, the food, the military threats. They could not see that wandering line that eventually led from Ramses to Jericho. And surely, it's satisfying and uplifting to be able to reflect back on a series of struggles, interspersed with joyful moments, but to realize that this was your path, that you had the resilience to overcome so many obstacles, that you had moments of joyfulness. However, our meditation practice prepares us to experience our life journey in a radically different way. Particularly in Zen practice, it's not our goal to connect the dots in order to measure where we started and how far we have come. Rather, our meditation practice teaches that all of our life journey and all of the different stages of the journey are part of a great flowing river of reality unfolding. Even though we can point to guideposts, this is where we started, this is where we stopped, there is no starting point and no stopping point that is separate from the flow of reality. Our lives are not separate, but are different currents in the river merging together, moving apart, completely inseparable from the rest of the water. So I'll end with the familiar story that is often told in meditation practice, different versions of the little wave and the big wave as they approach the shore. The big wave is panicking, telling the little wave, "If you were tall enough to see what I see, you'd be in a panic too. Up ahead, we're going to crash into the shore and it will be all over for us." The little wave looks ahead and sees something different. Yes, each wave crashes on the shore, splashing and spraying water into the air, but each wave returns to the ocean. It is still water, no longer in its previous wave form, but merging again with the sea, remaining part of the great ocean. When the wave sees itself as water, it's liberated from its panic, no longer fearing the loss of its illusion of separateness as a wave. Our practice may allow us, in brief moments, to experience our lives as part of this flowing river of reality where beginnings and endings merge into a ceaseless stream, where the gradual loss of form and separateness that are part of aging and death feel like a natural unfolding, part of an endless flow. So let's take a few moments of silence, sitting with our awareness of our life journeys as empty of separateness, simply part of the great flowing river of reality unfolding.